Welcome to Full Prefrontal, the show that exposes the mysteries of executive function. This podcast is a collection of conversations about the role of the prefrontal cortex, which impacts your focus, planning, problem solving, emotional balance, and independence. So join us as we explore executive function and the science of learning. And now, here's your host, the founder of EXQ, Sucheta Kamath.
Welcome back to Full Prefrontal, where we discuss executive functions, self-awareness, self-management, and we figure out ways so that people can become wonderful, self-regulated people, people who have what it takes to achieve their goals and find fulfillment because they know how they think, how they act, how they behave, and they have the tools within them to change themselves. And it's going to be a great discussion today. I'm your host, Sucheta Kamath. I have a dear friend and a colleague who is a guru of executive function, and you can wake him up in the middle of the night and ask him any question, and he can answer that very successfully because he lives wonderful topic. And so before I get him on here, I wanted to kind of just set the stage for all of you. Whenever I think about executive function, I like to imagine that I'm on a plane and somebody sits next to you and says, what do you do for a living? And you should be in one sentence, be able to tell what you do. So I wish in that way I was a plumber because I don't need to tell what plumber does. But when I tell people I work with executive function, that itself leads to like at least 10 minutes of conversation, which is very annoying because I wish. So this podcast is really making an effort to make this as a commonplace statement or language, so people don't need an explanation of what it is. And second thing I'll say about executive function is one only recognizes the need and value of executive function in absence of it. And so absence or lack of executive function is much to talk about than when they're present. So when you show up somewhere on time, when you actually turn something in on time, or so you actually read people's mind, when you understand what was the implicit in a given condition, you are using great executive function. So I am wishing you all that you activate your executive function as you listen to this particular interview because you're up for a treat. So it's my great pleasure to introduce George Makowski. He is a professor and director of school psychology research in the School of Professional and Applied Psychology of the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine, and he holds diplomat status with the American Academy of Pediatric Neuropsychology. Dr. Makowski has amassed 40 years of experience in test development, teaching, research, and assessment and intervention work, which is my favorite part of his work because he doesn't leave us hanging. He gives us some solutions and a wide range of clients, and has developed a comprehensive model of executive function that can be used to guide assessment and intervention. He frequently presents to packed audiences, rooms packed with audiences who are eager to learn from him, and he is a lead author of the books Assessment and Intervention of Executive Function Difficulties and Essentials of Executive Function Assessment. He has also developed, of course, this is getting a little nerdy on my part, so bear with me, but he has a scale called MEFS, which is a Makowski Executive Function Scales. Very, very useful, a teacher and a parent forms that allows you to gauge a student's level of competence by asking questions of teachers, parents, and students themselves. So welcome to the podcast, George. How are you?
Thank you very much, Sucheta. I'm very good, very busy, as you are also. It's just a very different and very stressful time for a lot of people with the COVID situation and just all the uncertainty of getting back into schools and figuring out how to do all this effectively and do it in a safe and healthy way. It's been a challenge.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, and I share your sentiment, but I'm glad that a lot of students have access to you and a lot of parents have your guidance. So you're easing some people's lives for sure. So as we talk about executive function, let me ask you about your own executive function. What kind of student were you and what kind of self-regulation you had as a child? Were you attuned with your strengths and weaknesses when you're growing up?
Very good. Yeah. Well, I think let's say I had a varied profile of self-regulation abilities and skills. So there were some things that I was doing very well, perhaps better than most of my peers, and some things I was really very far behind my peers in. So self-regulation for me.
What kind of examples can you give
well,
us?
Well, I think, but here's the thing. I think the majority of it is tied to motivation.
I see.
And, you know, in my model, it goes beyond self-regulation. So we're talking about when you become self-determined and self-realized and beyond that. And I think that was the shift for me, you know, between 10 and 12, I became very self-determined. There were some things going on in my home that I realized related to mental health issues for, you know, the family. And from that point on, it became very clear to me that there was need for my capacity for self-determination to be in place and to guide a lot of things. And so from that point on, the things that motivated me were certainly of great interest, and self-regulation in those situations was not a problem. In situations where I was being told to do things or else, and, wow. And where I felt like I had a loss of self-determination, created a lot of dissonance within me and certainly reduced my ability to self-regulate very effectively, because it was not motivated. And so in those situations, my ability to stay on task and to complete assignments and complete, you know, I could find anything to do besides what I was supposed to be doing at the time. So distractibility was a major problem for me when it came to things that other people wanted me to do. When it came to things that I wanted to do, there was pretty much no stopping me. And of course, many people would say, well, that's an ADHD profile. And I appreciate that there are certainly some aspects of that that were within my own profile when I was growing up. But as I said, there were also other aspects related to the way I treated other individuals and how I related that were very different. And I think this just, that mixed profile was always very confusing to me, but it's why I developed the ideas and tested the ideas that I have now today, because I think in our culture today, we over-pathologize a lot and our whole system of mental health is based on the idea that you cannot receive services and be reimbursed for those services unless you have a label. And that label has to be something that's wrong with you. And I think that's where we start right there from the beginning, thinking that anyone who needs some assistance or needs some help or some ideas of how to improve themselves, there must be something wrong with them. And I don't buy that at all. I think that there are certainly people that do have pathologies. And when something interferes with your life to the extent that, you know, the value of your life and what you're doing is compromised by things that are happening to you, the quality of life is affected greatly, then I think we start talking about disorders and we talk about treating those. But prior to that, there's just many, many people that have difficulties in many different ways. And a pattern of strengths and weaknesses, everyone. You know, there are just things they do well, things they struggle with. And the question is, what is it that you're struggling with? And what can we do to help you figure out how to do that better? And how can we help you take advantage of those strengths you have and use them sometimes to compensate for those weaknesses when necessary? So this has always been my idea, that there's this mix. It's never black or white. You are this or not. You probably have some of those traits and you'd like to fix those or change those. That's great. And if those are the only things that are wrong, that's okay. You don't have to fit the whole profile, right? I only have 4 of the 7, you know, characteristics. So maybe I'm not that. Well, it's really not an issue of are you or aren't you. It's what are you having trouble with? And what do you want to change? And so that's always been my perspective. And I from a very young age, I had a perspective of the idea of wanting to change myself to be the person I wanted to be. And when I wasn't the person I wanted to be, I was very frustrated. You know, and so I would feel very self-defeated. And so there was always this constant, how do you fix that up? How do you change it?
So I think one part that really reverberates with me about young George is you had incredible insight. You may not have had the skills, but you kind of identified and recognized things that you could do better, and figuring them out could be a gradual process. So I really appreciate that. The reason I asked that question is because I think sometimes people are so deeply committed to whatever they're studying and researching, my guests particularly, they're highly specialized. And if they're asked to remember their younger versions, you know, we tend to forget our younger versions. But we are dealing with people.
I know what you mean.
Right? And I'm really interested in kind of humanizing some of the barriers that young generation has, younger people have, as we recognize in them there's a better version somewhere hidden there, but what would be the reason that they might work. So let's set the stage for this conversation about executive function. What is it? How do you define it? And it's how does this relate to agency, or one's sense of control they have over their life? And how does this connect with self-efficacy, their ability to feel successful by ways in which you do things? Are they all related? How do you define that?
That's a very broad question, and lots of things involved there. And I think sometimes I mentioned motivation as within my own context, in my own situation, and that has always been a basis of trying to look at the world and understand why people are doing what they do and how they do it, and the recognition of where there's great motivation and where there's a lack of it, and how that affects and impacts. And the more I understood about neuropsychology, the more I understood about functioning of the brain and the role of motivation. We always had these, personality motivation courses and learning and motivation. And motivation was always this very, ephemeral thing that we always talked about, but never really had much in the way of an understanding or definition. And very often, I think, because executive functions, this idea of executive functions is the one about the some people, have a very simple idea of a CEO of the brain, the idea that there's this control center within the brain that directs all of your perceptions, feeling, thoughts, and actions. And I think that's an oversimplification. I do think that within the frontal lobes, we do have a supervisory system that has many different components, and they work together. And so it's not one single unitary location within your frontal lobe, but there's lots of elements within your frontal lobe that are responsible for helping you take control of your perceptions, feelings, thoughts, and actions. Mm. And I began to realize that that circuitry within the frontal lobe is not the circuitry of motivation, that the circuitry of motivation is different, and that it includes many subcortical areas of the brain, but also that there's a connection, though, a very strong connection between those frontal lobe executive functions, how to self-regulate every day, and how to make sure you're doing what you should be doing at any given time. Well, what is it that you should be doing? Well, that depends on your motivation, whether you're listening to what someone else is telling you to do because it's going to be good for you, or whether you listen to yourself because you know that's what you want to do. Either of those is tied to your motivation very much.
Yes.
And if you're lacking in motivation, then you're simply listening to individuals because you fear the consequences of not listening to them, or there's so much of there's a negative consequence involved and you'd really rather not pay it. And of course, that becomes a motivation. So the idea is, like, how do you take this thing called motivation, which is this, seeking positive things or avoiding negative things, and creating it becoming that source for you to get the things that you want and to direct yourself effectively to get those things. In order to do that, there has to be a connection between motivation and the frontal lobes. And there's lots of connections between the motivational center and executive capacities, to the extent that when you are motivated to do something, or if you're doing something you like, you are at your best. You will self-regulate and use executive functions at your best when you're highly motivated. When you're not motivated, it's almost, for some people, it's almost impossible to access those self-regulation capacities and get things done, because it's just not, we don't have that special push from the motivation center. So motivation kind of energizes this whole system of frontal lobe function. And once you have that energy and you're energized, then it's surprising what some individuals are able to accomplish with the self-regulation. So in models of change within our field, that idea that do you want to change? You say these things are a problem for you, but do you really want to change? And do you really want to create a new, this new you, how you want to function? And if that's the case, then you will be motivated. But if you say you want to change, but you're not going to have the motivation. So you can start a therapeutic approach, an intervention, but you just won't follow through with it because you really haven't committed to the change process yet. And so I love the work of Prochaska and DiClemente and Norcross, the Changing for Good, a model of change, six stages of change. And, the first are pre-contemplation, contemplation, And then preparation for change. And then the fourth stage is change. So there are three stages before you even get to the point of changing. And it just takes brains a while before they really wake up to the idea that you really do have to be committed from a motivation perspective to see that change. And so for me, with my clients, my major job is helping them see where they are at motivationally speaking, get to that point where they need to be motivationally, and then we can start talking about those strategies we can use to begin that change process, you know, to alter the way you self-regulate. And so for me, that's, you know, that's that therapeutic approach. But that self-regulation piece is, how do you perceive, feel, think, and act every day? How do you guide your thoughts, your perceptions, your feelings, your actions? So you're doing at any given point in time, you're doing the things that are going to be beneficial to you, and that will enable you to accomplish the things you want to accomplish and not be at odds with yourself. You know, some people, you go home and you say, wow, why did I say that? Why did I do that? You know, why did I think about this? And so there are all these things that we, after the fact, kind of reflect on sometimes and just weren't there in the moment and able to do that. And so there's this other component of executive control I talk about with self-realization. You know, the more aware that that need to align your self-regulation with your self-determined motives, and the awareness of how far on or off of that you are, enables you to become more self-regulated. So within individuals from the age of 10 and 14 and up, these three aspects of self-determination and self-realization and self-regulation, they all have to work together within the brain. And that's the big challenge of adolescence from age 10 to 25 is awakening and developing this capacity for self-determination, goal setting, long-term planning, the capacity to be aware of who you are, to realize your strengths and weaknesses, to self-reflect, and to be aware of others and how you impact them and how they impact you.
Pause here for a second.
Yeah.
So let me get this straight. So one thing I really appreciate you, not many people frame it this way, even though they specialize talking about executive function, that this motivational system, the subcortical systems, the systems in the deeper crevices of the brain govern these, what gets you activated, what gets you going. And then there's the direction. Where are you going? And do you have a better way of going there? And they need to talk to each other, or they need to be in sync with each other. And then you're talking about this, the self-reflection piece, which comes at the end, when of course the success comes from you watching what you're doing and monitor what you're doing as you're doing it, which mm-hmm. is of course maturation factor or good self-reflection tied back into redirecting action. So these three pieces together, to me, what sounds like you are describing brings self-efficacy, like to become good yes. at doing something well and continuously keeping track if something went well or did not go well is a marriage between these three things, correct?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Yeah, very much so. And it forms your belief system, right? Your structure of your beliefs about yourself.
And so tell us,
do you believe you're good?
Yeah. So I would love for you to then talk about this, because one of the things, and I don't know if you find this frustrating or not, but there's been a great conversation about mindsets. Mm-hmm. And suddenly mindsets are brought in as if somebody's growing up with things, and then you talk to them about having a growth mindset. Well, growth mindset is not external, or it's not a lecture-based learning. It's not somebody says, George, have a good growth mindset, right?
Well, that's a good point.
Because it requires some level of experimentation with your approach and results, and then keep evaluating that. So can you talk a little bit about, I don't know if I'm... If this is a best suited question or not, but I would love for you to talk about that relationship to self-efficacy to me, because greater than executive function is equipping people with the knowledge of self that allows them to regulate self, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, it does. And that self-efficacy piece, that's that, you know, pulling together that self-determination, self-realization. But then that aspect of once you are there, and you begin to realize these things. These are things I want, and these are things I don't do so well, and things I do well, and this is how I impact others and how they impact me. Once you have that sense, you know, and you're there, you need to build that the capacity for saying, to see where there are situations in which things you may be doing are not going to help you get the things that you want. And this becomes very frustrating for some people who are highly motivated. They have these goals, they have lofty goals, and they know what they want to do, but they just cannot, they can't self-regulate throughout the day to do the things they need to do to accomplish those things. And so that very much ties in that idea of a growth mindset. You know, fixed mindset would be, well, you would only accomplish those things if you have the ability to accomplish them. And so if you look at yourself and say, well, I don't have certain abilities, even though I have these goals, and these goals require those abilities, I guess I can't have that goal because I don't have those abilities. And that would be a fixed mindset. But the belief system here is that growth mindset, which is, well, if that's what I need to accomplish that, then I have to reevaluate that goal. Do I want it or don't I? If I do, then how do I develop those capacities that I don't have? So that's that growth mindset of whatever it is that you want, you can develop and grow to get that, to achieve that. But it's not going to be just a matter of wishing that it happens. It's you have to have some sort of a plan, an idea, a belief structure that's going to guide you in doing what you need to do to make sure that you develop those skills and abilities that are necessary for you to accomplish those goals. And it's not a matter of what, I hope you have that, because if you don't, you'll never do that. And of course, in sports, we see lots of examples of individuals with lots and lots of talent who really never accomplish much in their sports area because the motivation for them to do that is not very really there. Or they can't self-regulate to accomplish it. But there are other individuals who are motivated to perform well in sports, don't have the innate abilities that other athletes do have, but the fact that they practice so much and that they use what they have and they compensate for weaknesses or develop as much as they can those areas that are weaker so they get stronger. And you see that growth mindset and you see them now they accomplish those goals that they've set for themselves because they're willing to put the work, the time, energy, you know, and it's three things to me. I used to say time, energy, and effort, but really it's intention, time, and energy. And if you have the intention and you're willing to put the energy into it, And be patient with the amount of time it takes, there is very little that you can't accomplish. And I've seen some individuals make some very dramatic change in their lives because of their ability to see that and to maintain that motivation and to work very, very hard to accomplish and achieve what they want to accomplish.
So can we talk a little bit about this energy, this capacity to put forth the mental effort, is this same as capacity to handle the cognitive load? Is this same as one's capacity to sustain mental, sustain attention and intention to follow through with complexity of things? How does this translate into having that mental energy? Because sometimes I see students kind of wah-wah-wah effect, you know, like they start off well and as they continue, they feel exhaustion and then they don't have this refueling process or they don't recognize that there's certain tasks are extremely energy consuming. So how do you understand that, or how would you explain that with the clients that you work with? Like, what role does this energy play in one's ability to direct them?
Yeah, it's that is often at the center of a lot of things, because for some individuals, if they can't see the results within a week or two, they get very discouraged, and they'll throw themselves into it, and they'll do, you know, and they'll try to catch up, you know, in a week's time. And I often have to help them develop that patience as necessary to realize. Ellen Langer has a model she calls the reverse Zeno's paradox, which is the idea that you know, Zeno's paradox, if you fire an arrow at a target and you took a stop action photograph of that arrow approaching the target, you could take the distance between the arrow and the target and you could have it. No matter how close the arrow gets to the target, you can always have that distance to infinity. So the arrow never reaches the target, you know, rationally thinking that way, that's the paradox. But she says, well, instead of having things to infinity, think of intervention with a brain that needs to develop and grow as the reverse of that, which is doubling the effect. Every time you do something that you need to do the way you need to do it, it is making connections within your brain. And those neurons are beginning to understand you want us to fire together and work together. And so that forms an idea, they call an identity. And that identity is the idea of neurons that fire together, wire together. And now you use them once, they go, okay, that's once. you do it again, and they go, oh, that's the same neuron pattern again and again. And the more times you do it, the brain begins to realize that you want us to fire together. It's more efficient at firing that. But every time you do it, it's an infinitesimally small effect. And now you do it again, you've doubled the effect. You do it again, you've doubled. How long do you have to keep doubling the effect before you can actually see a real change in the world? So you're changing your brain long before you change your behavior. And this is what individuals who don't see result, I'm doing it, but I'm not getting result. You're doing it and you are getting result. You're just not seeing that result yet. But the thing you need to do is to continue to do it. And then, interestingly, with Zeno's reverse paradox, the idea that once you are able to see it, it's now exponential. And it's just, when you start doubling something you can see, it becomes exponential. And it's like an explosion of growth. And it seems to be overnight. And people say, wow, she's doing that all the time now. She was never doing that. Now she does all the time. Is that hormones or what? Because now she's an adolescent. And I have to say, no, we've been working on this for 5 years. See, that's not overnight. That's the result of 5 years of work. And now we're seeing the payoff. But if you didn't put the 5 years in, we wouldn't have seen that explosion of growth. So we often expect to see that explosion of growth without putting in the necessary time to build the substrate within those neural substrates in the brain that are going to function effectively to get you where you want to be. And it's a lot of hard work. And sometimes you get nothing back from it. You just have to, have the belief that if I continue to do this and do it the way I'm supposed to do it, at some point it's going to be extremely easy for me to do. And that's really that. And now once you've gotten to that point, see, now you've automated that process and you can move on to something else that you need to take care of. But it's really that idea that things won't just become easy. And if it's easy for you, you have that idea. If it's not easy, then, I'm not going to take it on. And if it's easy for me and I'm really good at it, that's great. No, but is there something that you want to do that's not easy for you to do? Then can you put the time, intention, energy and effort into that to become really good at that, that intention, energy and time? Are you willing to put that in? And if you are, then you can accomplish that. But in interventions, it's very discouraging initially for a number of individuals because they'll do well for a week. They're motivated. That motivation is there. Sometimes it's hard to maintain that motivation over time. And there's just these lapses and there will be days you're not there. And so when I talk about that growth of executive capacities, it's sort of this up and down thing. Some days you're there, some days you're not. And we're just trying to get gradually over time more on than off. You'll still be off at times, but you'll be off fewer times than you used to be. And there'll be a point where you'll be on so often, you won't even notice those few times when you're not. But for right now, you're off a lot. But if we don't track that, so progress monitoring, I have found, becomes very critical in almost every intervention that I do. If you're not keeping track of whether you're changing or not, it's so easy to get, subjective opinions are not going to do the job. You need to have some data that you're tracking to see that up and down growth, but that upward slope, even though there's some days when you're up and down, the line looks like this, but the slope is upward. And, there'll be days when you won't be there, days, weeks, maybe even months. But, overall, you are making progress toward the goal. And that's the part that I have to keep encouraging my clients to stay with. And so I do a lot of progress monitoring and show it to them or have them do their own progress monitoring so they can see the change.
So, George, you thank you for giving us that the broader picture of helping people develop the framework of success and kind of knowing how to even gauge success or progress, as you mentioned, happening. Before we go into more depth of intervention, can we backtrack a little bit? How do executive function problems show up in everyday classroom for a student or even everyday life at home? How do you break that down? You have a very thorough system of assessing or not assessing, but kind of framing understanding of executive function. So what would you say to our listeners? What's a broad strokes on understanding executive function and dysfunction as it shows up?
Yeah, I think it's kind of layered. I think from early preschool, ages 2 or 3, attention issues are probably the most easily noticeable. And if they persist, they're the ones you want to address first. So just that ability to focus attention on a particular topic or idea or person in the environment, and the ability to sustain attention for a particular amount of time. But just also the ability to activate your sensory systems and use them, and then focus attention, sustain it. And when you're in preschool, And in kindergarten, that gets noticed very quickly if you can't do that. So that's one of the first, you know, executive capacities that people are aware of that they want individuals to use. And appreciate with little children, they're not so self-motivated. They're really responding to us as adults and the environment. And so we're trying to shape a lot of that. And so attention is what we want from individuals to help them grow and develop their frontal lobes. And so that's the first thing. And then we're looking for engagement. We're looking for them to initiate activities. We're looking for them to inhibit impulsive responding, you know, don't do things when we tell you not to do them. We're looking for you to be able to stop and interrupt ongoing activity, pause briefly and get back to what you were doing, shift, be flexible. These are things that get noticed around 4, 5, 6, starting, in that preschool and in kindergarten age range. You get to elementary school, people are expecting you to be able to check your work for errors. To kind of modulate your feelings, right? You can be silly, but not too silly. You can get upset, but not too upset. So we're looking for that kind of ability when we get into elementary school to correct mistakes, find your mistakes, correct them, balance, have sense of balance, right? Don't tell jokes all the time. It's time to be serious, time to be funny. And then we're looking at, you know, moving into memory system. Can you manage your memory system? There'll be a test on Friday. You need to study for it. What does study mean? What does a test mean? So just all that ability to figure out how to store information and retrieve it effectively is an aspect of executive control, because we all have memories, we have a memory system, but do we know how to manage it? And that's that executive control of memory. And so that kicks in late elementary. You get to middle school, people are asking you to do all that, be responsible for your actions, right? Know how to do all those things, but now also take on the idea of identifying problems, gauging difficulty, estimating time, and figuring out, you know, how the best way to get things done. And then by the time you're in high school, we expect you to be able to plan and organize, make good decisions and prioritize. And so all these are executive control aspects. These are all aspects of frontal lobe function. You can see how, as you go through school, at certain points, if you don't keep up with the executive control development that they're asking for, you can fall behind. You can easily fall behind. And then we just have to catch up. And there's lots of individuals that the shift from preschool to kindergarten, kindergarten to elementary, elementary to middle school, middle to high school, these shift points start to show up where there are these weaknesses. Oh, you don't have that set of skills that we, and none of these are taught. All these things we're talking about are aspects of executive control that we just expect individuals to develop on their own with a few cues from us and maybe a little bit of modeling. But it's never really, it's sort of like a hidden curriculum. But the expectation is there that you are developing these things. And if you're not, you're probably not going to get good grades. You're probably not going to succeed in school. And so we see the problems, but we don't identify the source as executively related a lot of times.
If I can quote you, I love you have written that executive functions are not the mental processes we use to perceive, feel, think, and act, but rather are the processes that direct or cue the engagement and use of the mental processes that we use to perceive, feel, and think, and act. I think you just summarized that beautifully.
And to expand on that, it's the first part is knowing how. Do you know how to pay attention? Which means, can you cue the neural networks in your brain that are responsible for attention when you need attention? And so do you know how to get that attention out of your brain? Now, do you know when to do that? So knowing how and knowing when are a little two different aspects of executive control. And I call knowing how being the skill. Do you have the skill? Can you pay attention? Meaning, can you cue the parts of your brain that are responsible for paying attention? Do you know how to get yourself to pay attention? Now, do you know when to get yourself to pay attention? That's an executive function. And so functions are really about, do you know when to do all these things? And then the skill is, do you know how to do them? And if you don't know how to do them, we step back, teach you how to do them. But now we have that other piece, which is we need to help you understand the conditions that you should identify and recognize so you know when to do them. And so that how and when are very important. That's the source of executive control.
I love that.
And all the rest of it are the workers in the brain that have to do it, right?
Yeah. Because I love this, because it's, so one is, do you know? And then second is, are you doing what you know? So, you know, like.
Yeah. When you need to do it.
When you're supposed to do it. So, you know, playground, loud voice, loud noise, and library, quiet noise, quiet voice. And if you flip it, then it's a lack of executive control. You're talking loudly in the library. And you're already in trouble.
And it baffles teachers and parents too, because they'll say, I've seen him do it. He could do it if he wanted to. But the issue is they know how. They just aren't picking up on the cues for when.
Exactly.
And we have to help them understand when to use those abilities they have appropriately. Because you say you've seen them do it before, but also there's that motivation thing, right? And when did you see them do it, right? Video games, they could pay attention for hours. Math homework, 15 seconds. And you go, well, that's not an attention problem. And that's not executive function problem. That's a motivation problem.
So another thing that you do really well, George, is you make a distinction between learning difficulties and producing difficulties. Mm-hmm. So first, what are they and how are they different? Because that certainly influences strategy instruction, isn't it?
Yeah, it does. And so I think of the executive functions and skills as that supervisory system of the brain. It tells and the how supervisors, skill supervisors, tell the workers what to do. Pay attention. That requires certain parts of your brain to pay attention. They have to be activated. So your brain, the HAL circuit within the frontal lobe knows the parts of the brain needed for paying attention and activates them. And then the when tells you when you should do that. And that's the executive control system. But those workers that are being activated, they need to be able to do their job. And so sometimes we find that within certain brains, there are certain areas within the brain that are not as developed as they should be, underdeveloped, you know, or perhaps damaged. And so now we're not able to do certain things. And that's a learning disability. Learning disabilities really have to do with the workers in the brain, parts of the brain that may be compromised and make it difficult for you to do something. If you can't hear subword sound units, it gets very difficult for you to understand how to decode words, and you'll probably be a very poor reader. And so those workers create a learning disability. If you have a phonological deficit, certain areas within the left hemisphere don't process subword sound details in words the way they should, that's a worker problem. We fix up the worker, and now you can do that. But the executive control system is about producing. And so production is that even if you know how to do things, will you know when to do them? And that lack of knowing when, especially knowing when, but also knowing how. So you have these workers available to you at your disposal. You just don't know how to get them activated as first, and they don't know when to get them activated. So producing disabilities are about individuals who seem to have a lot of ability but aren't able to produce on command in school or at home. And so it's that lack of production that we see. Wow, he's so smart, he's so capable, but he's failing everything. Then you sit down with the individual and realize they're highly motivated, but they're not able to pull it off. And this is a producing disability or producing difficulty. You really don't know how to get your brain to do what it needs to do, or don't know when to get it to do what it knows how to do. So now the intervention becomes very much, you know, taking on helping the individual with the producing difficulties that they have. And the learning difficulties, though, are about weak workers. Workers who aren't able to do their job very well. Intellectual disability, reasoning areas of the brain are compromised. Language impairment, you know, the language centers of the brain are not functioning effectively. Now, if we can get in there and we can strengthen those workers, we are remediating a learning disability. But once that's done, or as that's being accomplished, there's still that issue of producing. And you can have an individual with both problems, both learning and producing difficulties, and they're the hardest to teach. And the fascinating part about school is we don't identify on the basis of learning disabilities. We refer on the basis of producing difficulties because we can see the lack of production, but we can't see the lack of learning in the brain. And so the lack of production gets you referred early. And we identify a learning disability and we say, oh, that's why you weren't producing. Not really. There's a learning disability here we found, but if we also don't address that producing difficulty, we're going to teach this brain how to strengthen the workers, but you still might not see what you want from that brain efficiently and effectively because it may still not know how to get it out of itself when you're not around. And so in those interventions, we see that up and down, you know, they make progress. So they decode sometimes and sometimes they don't. And you have to remind them, you know, to use the skills they have. And that means we're there being their frontal lobe all the time.
You know, I really love this distinction because I think it also kind of outlines, as you mentioned, intervention, but it also allows you to help the student know why there are certain different approaches to way of becoming successful in the academic or non-academic endeavors. Allow me to indulge myself. I use a building analogy. I say there is an architect who creates the design, and then there's a project manager or the construction manager, and then there are bricklayers. So the bricklayers are the skills. So you know, if the bricklayers show up, but there is no plan, there's no architect who has never designed the entire plan, even the construction manager cannot do it. But once the plan is laid out, and a lot of times I find that teachers, educators, coaches or parents become the architect. Or construction managers or the bricklayers, but they have to really understand this kid needs to do it all. And so that's how you hand over the skill set from eventually a person who becomes the architect of their own navigation of life are going to also know that sometimes I have to change my hat from a bricklayer to an architect and architect back to the bricklayer.
Yeah. Nicely put. And it's a great analogy. And I think one of the things it also emphasizes, as you mentioned, is that while parents and teachers can become the architect, eventually the goal of all this is for you to become the architect, for the child themselves to become the architect.
Yes.
And the manager and have this and the work. So and that's that intervention continuum of moving from external control where other people assist you through bridging strategies to the point where you become self-regulated, where you're actually running all those components. And so that shifting from being externally controlled to internally self-regulated, we have to find those strategies to go from there. You know, we can't just say to you, now you take it on. It's yours now, right?
Yes.
We have to have some form of instruction, a strategy that bridges where it takes it from them, you know, us telling them externally controlling to them seeing what we're doing, seeing how we're doing it, taking on those strategies for themselves, learning how to use them, getting good at them, receiving feedback, and then beginning to use them so well that we just fade our feedback and step out of the picture, and now they're internally self-regulated. So it's that gradual shift from having someone else be the architect to you becoming the architect. But it's something you have to learn how to do. And
yes.
It's something that lots of individuals need a lot of guidance with.
And what's so amazing to me, George, is how miraculously it's present in so many children as they become adolescent and adults. So when executive functions do show up,
they do for a lot of individuals, don't they? Which is why we never really talked about it.
If everybody never acknowledged it.
If everybody couldn't do it, we'd be talking about this all the time. But it seems like your peers are doing it. Why aren't you?
Yes.
And, you know, even if it's just as little as 5% or 10%, you know, it could get as high as 20, 25%. The fact that 75% of individuals kind of roll with it and learn along the way, you know, on their own, and their brains are able to kind of like get with the program.
Shift the roles.
We just assume everybody should be like that. And the reality is, even those 75%, there are gaps. There are things they're not really processing about how they did that so that they can have that perspective they need. With their peers or with their own children when they become, you know, parents, or with their students when they become teachers. Because, it was so easy for you and effortless, it seemed, right? But there were some rough spots, and think about that. And think about some of the blind spots you still have, or some, you know, strengths and weaknesses, some things that you really haven't gotten to. And when you can apply this model, you know, it becomes a model of positive change for everyone, not just the individuals that really, really need it. Because if they don't get it, they're really at risk of failure. Dropping out of school, you know, and becoming, you know, non-contributing members of society, or not being able to create a meaningful life for themselves, you know, following some path that has some sort of meaning to them. And, you know, they lose that access, you know, to life. And I think that's a real, we know that's what we try to help individuals with, because we know what the tragedy that is.
Now, George, I know you present and you train for days, not just a day, and it's kind of a tall order for me to have you for 45 minutes, but tell me in the remaining time, as we think about supporting or developing skills, choose one of your favorite skill set that you feel is a really important skill for as we teach children to develop executive function is like a primo skill. And also secondly, an advice you might give to those who support children with difficulties as these skills are emerging or not emerging fast enough, what stance they can take.
Yeah, that's a question that I hadn't really gotten before when you said, you know, before we started. It started to make me think a bit. You know, the move toward mindfulness today, it has really kind of brought to the forefront a lot of the elements that we talked about with self-realization. And self-regulation is just is a more basic level of executive control. And self-regulating, you get up and you do it every day. And if you're not very good at it, you know, you can improve. But as I mentioned, if you have that self-realization component, you can be aware of when it is that you're functioning effectively or not. And you can quickly see when you're not and try to make some corrections. Or if you're given feedback, you can take that feedback and respond to it effectively. And so for me, and you say, well, so what's the one basic thing that would kind of strengthen self-regulation? It's an awareness of the fact that you have it and you need it and you can use it. And that comes through mindfulness practices from the youngest ages on. If you can create that gap between perception and action that enables you to engage your mind and to see things more clearly and be aware of the fact that you're about to make a mistake, you know, or you're about to go off track. And then just that ability to let that go. And, you know, if it's something someone says that upsets you, you just let it go. And then, this is the basis of meditation, isn't it? Meditative practice.
It is.
The thought comes to your mind, you just let it go. And you don't follow that thought, you just let it go. And then you just refocus on your breath. And that basic mindfulness practice that could lead to meditation is really a strengthening of all the capacities in the frontal lobe that will enable you to integrate all these aspects we talked about, to have better self-regulation, to connect it up more effectively with self-realization and self-determination. And self-realization is awareness of your awareness, right? Of that, you know, self-regulation, there's an awareness aspect, but we're talking about meta-awareness. If you can maintain an awareness of your awareness, you can self-regulate more effectively. And the first steps into that for younger children are mindfulness practices, just beginning to understand how to sit calmly and follow your breath and just let it in, let it out, and let other things go and just be there present in the moment, because that self-realization has to be a moment-to-moment awareness that stays with you, that enables you then to choose how to self-regulate at any given point in time.
Thank you for kind of highlighting. I was very curious about your answer, actually. And, you know, one of the things that you and I have talked about, which is so fascinating to me, that you actually, of all the researchers who talk about executive function, you make a categorical distinction and advocate for it, is the self-actualization. So taking that self-realization, self-awareness skills and transcending to a plane where you have not just aspiration to be a better person. Like, I have an aspiration to become a patient person. That will be a great commitment if I make that to myself. Yeah. I think the world around me will benefit from my commitment to that transcendent skill set. But I do think that transcendence is possible if we learn to just not just hang back, which is that mindfulness, but in that mindfulness, if we have some categorical information that we are evaluating and then all the corrective measures are taken from that, have a more lasting impact on changing our personality, changing our attitudes, changing our mindsets, and changing our tolerance for the world, right?
Oh, sure. Yes, and that we talk about growth mindset. We talk about so many of those things, but it's also a maturation of your motivation, right? We start out with immediate gratification motivation. We just want to, I want that. And when you're a little kid, that's how life is, right? And your parents have to go, no, you can't have that right now. And so we start having these constraints on our immediate gratification. But of course, by the time self-determination kicks in, self-determination is not about immediate gratification. It's about setting goals and achieving them, which requires delayed gratification. So we have to have been learning along the way to delay our immediate desires and to wait, you know, if we do what we need to do now, there will be a payoff later. So that delay of gratification becomes critical. But delay gratification for what? See, when we get to this level, you can set goals and you can delay gratification, you can achieve them, and you can get really good at that. But there should be this other aspect within you that starts refining your motivation to say, But why is that a goal that I have? Why do I want to accomplish that? What's the purpose of that? What's the meaning of that? Why do I want anything? And now you have to begin to develop some sort of a sense of ethics and morals that would guide what it is you want and why you want it. And understand that you need to relate to other people in the world and relate to the world in certain ways. And if you don't, it's not going to be good. And there's just, you know, things that are that everyone should be agreeing that are good and right, and things that are not very good. And it's, so that sense of right and wrong, that sense of good and bad, a moral ethical stance has to develop within the brain to kind of guide all that self-determination that you have and all those goals you want to set, so that you can be assured that that's, you're headed somewhere, you know, with some sort of a purpose. And then, of course, we talk about, you know, the ultimate steps in with that is, you know, what purpose is it that you're serving? What do you believe? And do you believe you have a CEO? Do you believe that there's that you are in control of your brain? Or do you believe you answer to a higher power? Or do you believe there's no higher power, it's just me? Well, then why would it be good for you to act in a moral and ethical manner? Or are you drawn to some higher sense of purpose? And does that higher sense of purpose give you an ethical and moral sense of how to be in the world? And these are also frontal lobe functions. And I understand what you said. Very often, as researchers do not talk about these aspects, because we're getting into the metaphysical here, right? And these are things that science kind of backs away from. But there are some scientists that are taking on. Andy Newberg, you know, studies this and looks at brains and transcendental meditative states and how that impacts their functioning. And the connection between these centers of the brain and the moral center of the brain, which is not the same as the center of the brain for self-regulating or being self-determined or self-realized. You know, they all interconnect, but they're aspects. And if you have an underutilized, underdeveloped moral sense, you can accomplish lots of things in the world. But if you crush everyone in your path, is that okay? And I think that's something that sometimes today we're not thinking about so well.
Well, thank you for this amazing conversation. I'm tempted to ask you to come back for part two if you're able to, because there's so much more to talk about. As we end our conversation here today, can you share two of your favorite books that you think have been meaningful to you? Maybe something personal, something professional. What do you have?
From 91 on, my exposure to the writings of Ken Wilber were really kind of eye-opening to me in terms of integrating all of this. And one of his books that he'd written, one of his most recent books, is called Integral Meditation. And it talks about the path of growing up, the cognitive development, and waking up, the consciousness development, and the putting of those two together. And I think it's a great read. You know, it's maybe a bit esoteric for a lot of people, but for me at this point in my life, it just really summarizes a lot of great thinking. But I think a very basic book that I like and it has, you know, anyone can access, is the book by the Dalai Lama, which is called Beyond Religion.
I love
ethics,
that book.
Ethics for a New World. And it's a small, very short book that is just packed with a tremendous amount of wisdom about, you know, that what is it to be good and bad, what is right and wrong, and how to develop that meditative mind. So that you can develop that self-reflected piece, self-realization, that's so important and so critical when he talks about compassion and talks about discernment, and intention. And these are things that are so important for us to develop and strengthen within frontal lobes. We need to understand and be able to discern the difference between right and wrong and good and bad, and have good intentions. We need to know that our intentions are clear and good, and we need to be compassionate, you know, toward others. Otherwise, there seems to be, not quite the, you know, the purpose or the reason for, you know, for all the things that we're doing. And so putting those things together, I found over the years that book is really kind of, it's relatively recent, right? But the Dalai Lama's ideas and thinking, you know, that have come through over the years are very evident in that book. And it's a very short, very small book. And I recommend it to everyone.
Thank you. Well, that's great. We will list them. This is a new thing I have added to the podcast. I think people of wisdom, and where they gain wisdom, maybe we can follow that trail. So thank you. I feel 50% better because I've read one of those two recommendations. So thank you, George, for being here with us today and making this podcast very, very special. I have deep respect for your work and commitment, and I have learned so much from you and continue to do so. So thank you for your time today. today. And thank you, all the listeners, for tuning in. If you love what you're hearing, share this on social media. Please invite your friends to like us, download us, or listen to us. And leave a comment. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me. But have a wonderful day. And thank you again for tuning in to this podcast, Full Prefrontal, Exposing the Mysteries of Executive Function. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, Susha. That was great. I appreciate it. I hope we can come back again. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Full Prefrontal, Exposing the Mysteries of Executive Function. To contact your host, Sucheta Kamath, and learn more about her work on improving executive function, visit her website at exqinfiniteknowhow.com. That's www.exqinfiniteknowhow.com. Tune in next week for another informative episode of Full Prefrontal, hosted by the founder of EXQ, Sucheta Kamath.